mechanical way, reacting to external demands or instruction rather than in ways determined by his own interests and energies and power. He says we may admire what he does, but we despise what he is. For Humboldt, then, man is born to inquire and create. And when a man or a child chooses to inquire or create out of his own free choice, then he becomes in his own terms an artist rather than a tool of production or a well-trained parent.
Hello and welcome to the 97th episode of the Diet Soap Podcast. It's hard to believe how one week just keeps blending into the next, but it's Thursday, March 31st, and I'm Douglas Lane, the host of this podcast. This week, Brendan Cooney returns for the second part of a two-part conversation about the economic crisis, the declining rate of profit, underconsumption, and our best pal, Karl Marx. Wait a minute, that's not Karl Marx. We also discuss net neutrality and the great Comcast Apple computer conspiracy. And the name of that conspiracy is, of course, capitalism. In other news, we lost a good one last week. Joe Bagent shed his mortal coil, and hopefully he's tripping balls with Tim Leary and Paul McCartney right now. Joe was a true working-class hero, a terrific writer. His books, Deer Hunting with Jesus and Rainbow Pie, put the red in redneck, while his spirit and humor put heart and soul back into politics. We'll miss you, Joe. Again, the guest this week is Brendan Cooney, who, as well as being a Marxist pedagogue, is also a musician. In fact, right now, you're listening to Fugue in C Minor, as covered by his group, the Rhinoceri Trio. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to our conversation about capitalism's cycles of crisis. The YouTube star Brendan Cooney has produced over 100 YouTube videos on the subject of Marxist economics and Marxist theories. The videos are really a series of lectures illustrated by the kinds of visual montages that are only possible in this internet age, with titles like Law of Value and the Fetishism of Commodities. You might think his work would be dry, but instead, he presents these videos and ideas in a lucid and accessible and entertaining way. But I wanted to talk to you about the declining rate of profit under capitalism and how that produces a crisis, and compare that to other theories, mainly the underconsumption theory, which is kind of also kicked around in Marxist circles.
Yeah. I mean, we really don't get in Marx a full theory of crisis. We get a lot from Marx, but we don't have some sort of finished theory of crisis. But we get, you know, a lot to work with. For Marx, it's this theory of the falling rate of profit, which is basically the idea that in the race to improve the efficiency of labor, capitalists are constantly investing more and more in machines and less in labor, because this gives them a temporary advantage in competition when they can produce under the socially necessary labor time. And we're always told that this increased efficiency of labor is something good, right? Because it produces more stuff. This gives us more cell phones for our ghettos. But Marx says, well, listen, if labor is the source of value and the social product contains less and less investment in labor and more investment in dead labor, that's the products of past labor, commodities, machines, raw materials and things, that means that less and less value is being produced relative to total spending by the capitalist class, which means that their rate of profit over time will tend to decline instead of raise. It might be good for capitalists in the short run and as individuals and their competition to be raising the productivity of labor. But in the long run, for the capitalists as a class, that their rate of profit will decline. And he says that over time, this declining rate of profit will create a problem for a capitalist looking to invest their capital in profitable places, and can lead to a crisis.
The reason why increased efficiencies will lead to a declining rate of profit is because what we're measuring is the socially necessary labor time or the labor time.
Yes.
In a commodity. And the other factors get factored out because a capitalist who invests in raw materials or a machine can't make a profit by turning around and selling that same stuff. He has to change it with labor, and that takes time. Otherwise, he can't. It would just be straight exchange with no surplus value.
This conversation, just tricky, right? Because I kind of want to sort of talk about things on one level, but then I don't want also how much am I assuming of what my audience already understands? I would hope they'd just be inspired to watch all my videos and read all three volumes of Capital, and then finish to the interview.
Right. Well, I want to clarify that.
I think I should clarify what it is that's unique about human labor in the terms of producing value and profit for a capitalist. If human labor is the only thing that creates value, and that's is what Marx thinks, that machines don't create value, then profit is made by exploiting human labor. A human makes $10 of value. You pay them $5 for their wage, and that's exploitation, and that's where all profit comes from Marx. Certainly, you can make all sorts of other profit in the economy, but that's just an appropriation of profit in exchange. Right, like I could be a landlord and I can make a profit by owning land, but I'm just appropriating value that's made somewhere else in the economy. The real value, I'm just sort of taking, wages, a part of the wage away from my tenants. But it's only in production that value is ever being created.
This is something that struck me about the internet recently, was that in the internet we may have this device that actually eliminates labor time.
Right.
In the reproduction of intellectual commodities.
Right.
So that is why it's so difficult to monetize. That's why the only way to make a profit off of it is to try to just grab the entire space and charge rent.
Yeah. That's why we have this battle over net neutrality, is because there's no labor involved in reproducing intellectual property. You can make 5 million copies of something by clicking your enter button on your computer. Your intellectual property, you can't commodify it. So that's why companies want to take our freedom of movement away from out of the internet. And that's why Apple is making all these products that are sort of do less than computers do. iPhones and iPads that sort of curtail your freedom of movement on the internet and sort of force you to buy applications and things from one company.
Right, and somehow we're all falling for it. This is what I don't
get. Yeah, you're right. Because we're told that the cell phones in the ghetto are going to make our lives better, Oh, look, iPhones, man. Look, it's awesome. My life is so much better now. But you were never no less free. We were more free back when we had, crappy PCs, and it was, 1999, and we were, stealing everything we could online.
Well, here's a question for you that's just a personal question for me, really, and I don't know if I'll keep it in the podcast. Why is it that, I write a novel, and I put it on the internet, and it's infinitely reproduced. How come the labor I put into making the novel, doesn't translate into value?
Right. Because... and this is something, it's interesting. You think Marx would have nothing to say about this, right? But actually, all through Volume 1, he makes this point that intellectual work is inherently social. And that's because, once I've set an idea, once I tell you, E equals MC squared or something, you have it. There's no labor. It's different than, if I was going to give you my cup of coffee, I had to, make some more coffee and do a little bit of work, but there's no labor. It's just sort of a unique aspect of intellectual labor is that it's an inherently social thing.
Because it's inherently social, it can't be commodified.
Yeah, unless you draw sort of arbitrary legal boundaries around it, a state comes and says, okay, you have a copyright for this song, or this drug patent, or this internet application or something. And they say that legally you're not allowed to. You have to pay to use this.
In other words, you have to have this kind of physical object, this medium for the commodity to cling to, in order for it to be.
Yeah, I mean, it's not true. I mean, there are some commodities that are not objects, right? Like a haircut is a commodity, and that's not an object. It's like a service. That's still a commodity. It's still wage labor. It's still, you know, a commodity with a use value and exchange value. But yeah, intellectual property needs to have some sort of thing that it can, I don't know, go into.
Right, and that's what Apple is creating.
That's what Apple's creating. Yeah, it's giving you this iPad that does a lot less than the internet, so that you can buy all the applications and then buy all the products for those applications. Or Amazon.com is creating the Kindle, so you can like buy all the books from Amazon.com instead of just downloading them for free from some other website. You know, a lot of the stuff you might buy for Kindle is like available free online already.
And you can even get it on your Kindle if you know how.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I have an iPod, like a, mm-hmm. you know, it's like an iPhone, only it doesn't have self-service.
Yeah.
But if I get Wi-Fi, I can make, with an app, I can use Skype and make a phone call.
Okay, yeah.
So with the internet, communication becomes inherently social because it's going to be infinitely reproduced. It's hard to commodify the communication technologies, and they're making a big effort to do that, to keep it in the realm of the market. But this is the struggle right now for net neutrality, and it's another example of how the market shapes reality and the technologies that are produced. Like for instance, Clear is really our cell phones become the internet because you're using the cellular signal to access the internet, and that's been deregulated now. And Comcast and Quest and all of these people who are providing us the internet now are investing in this other company because they want to kill the kind of internet we have now. They want to be able to continue to charge us for phone calls and for television and all of this stuff.
And what does it come down to? It always comes down to physical ownership over the means of communication, the means of disseminating around that now. Like how it always has to come down to property. If you right, so they can't own the anything else except for like the actual cable lines to your house. It's the only thing that gives them any, you know, power to control, or like the applications. I mean, there've been all these attempts for the past 15 years or so to like build into the applications themselves limits to the usefulness, so they try to stop piracy and stop the spread of information commodities, and they're constantly being overrun by, like, you know, these like 14-year-old kids in Sweden on their computers or something.
Shall we play a game?
Oh.
I think I missed them.
Yeah, weird, isn't it?
Yeah.
Love to.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, it's as, of course, as easy as it's always been. You get an iMac, 10 minutes out of the box, you're on the internet.
There's a revolution going on in rec rooms, offices, and classrooms around the world. A revolution in which 15 million people are taking part. They're sharing scientific data, arguing philosophy, or passing on cooking tips and gossip, night and day through a computer network called Internet.
What do purchasing an airline ticket from home, checking out your bank account, using an encyclopedia, reading newspapers from around the world, and using a phone without speaking a word all have in common? Well, they're all examples of what you can do on the internet via your personal computer just by lifting a finger.
What do you think the greatest gift of the holidays is? Internet? I'd say internet.
For about $200 a year, they log on to personal computers connected to phone lines and communicate across cultures and continents. Bill Cameron has this report on the growing phenomenon of internet.
Don't forget as you watch the TV that the fires of Belsen burn in the TV tubes every night. Don't forget that the structural principles of our society are as barbaric in their structure as they ever were, perhaps more so. Perhaps more so. We have to remember we're talking at a historical moment when most folks want to nuke somebody again. Why not?
So anyway, we were talking about underconsumption.
Oh, yeah, we got on a tangent about, see, sci-fi is just so, we're fascinated by sci-fi. It's so exciting. So that's the theory of the falling rate of profit, that things are getting cheaper and cheaper to produce, but actually that's not helping us in the long run with the profit. Now, it's not like a terminal stage of the falling rate of profit. It's not like at some point things get, you know, the profit gets so low that capitalism just like destroys itself. Capitalism goes into crisis. Factories close. Workers get laid off. And massive amounts of assets get bought up by the larger capitalists. And once enough destruction of capital has taken place, a recovery happens. And that's why I was saying earlier that like destructiveness is really healthy for capitalism. It devalues capital and allows like very specifically, like my factory is going out of business. I decide to sell it for way under its price to one of my competitors. Now my competitor can buy my factory way under its value, and that boosts his profit rate. And so that's how the profit rate recovers, by devaluation and the buying up of devalued property, which is exactly what's happening right now, right? Banks are foreclosing on billions of people's houses and people are buying them up at bargain basement prices. Factories are going out of business. There's this huge consolidation of all sorts of industries. And that's how recovery happens. The question is just like how much destruction is necessary given the size of the economy, given the global interdependence of nations, and sort of the vast amounts of speculation that have been taking place to try to prop up the economy over the past few decades. So much, you know, like capitalists don't like buy into a falling rate of profit easily. If they can't get a profit today by making widgets, they'll just invest in some sort of speculative asset. They'll buy real estate or stocks or hedge funds or whatever kind of crazy financial instruments they come up with. And they'll just sort of displace crisis in time, or they'll displace it in space by, you know, pushing the assets overseas or something. But once that sort of, it's almost like repressing the concept of crisis. Once that repression builds up enough pressure, it's going to burst at some point. And then, like, you know, then what happens is basically countries are going to try to like shove off that devaluation somewhere else. They're going to say, we don't want the devaluation in America. We'll like devalue the dollar a little bit, and then that'll sort of push the devaluation into some other country. And then you get like China and America fighting over the value of their currencies, and you have the real possibility for like inter-imperialist war. And for like really reactionary, oppressive states to come into power in order to sort of quell social unrest, and you have this sort of, you know, thing anyway, and that's exactly what we're seeing today. That's all part of this theory of the falling rate of profit. It's what we see today.
That's one theory of crisis, and I've been listening to this guy Rick Wolf, who talks about it in a narrower sense. He talks about how wages have been flat since the 70s. And the reason that happened was, I think, because of what you're describing, that became difficult because of the declining rate of profit to make a profit. The solution that was come up with was to push the problem overseas and to destroy the working class and here and in real terms to lower or flatten out wages. But when you talk about it that way, he kind of pushes the whole thing to become a realization problem, right? And maybe you could kind of point to why declining wages or declining consumption isn't necessarily the origin of the crisis, or isn't always the origin.
So basically, the idea is this: a huge part of the demand in the economy is not demand from workers; it's demand by capitalists to buy things from other capitalists. Productive inputs for the production process. And it's not true that all sort of production eventually resolves itself into a consumer good. A huge amount of the production in society is just production of capital goods for other capitalists. And that value just stays within the capitalist class, sort of going back and forth. I'm not talking about like luxury goods for the capitalist class, but just productive inputs. And it's totally possible that if there's a decline in wages and there's less consumer spending, that more capitalist investment can flow into the production of capital goods for the capitalist class. That's an analytical possibility, because there have been Marxists that have wanted to make, and historically that have wanted to make this point that it's impossible for capitalism to sell all of its products and realize its, you know, full rate of profit, because workers are always paid less than the full value that they produce, right? I'm exploited. I produce $10, but I get paid $5. Well, what happens to the other $5 of value? Well, people like Rosa Luxemburg historically said, well, the only way to sell the rest of those $5 is to expand markets overseas. And so Rosa Luxemburg wanted to say that eventually capitalism was going to expand so far there were no more markets to conquer, and then it would sort of run into this stagnation. And it's true, like, capitalism does expand its markets constantly trying to sell its product, but it doesn't mean that so a lot of the critics of under-consumption theory will say, like, there's no way you can argue that falling wages automatically means a crisis, because why can't capitalists just sell to themselves? Why wouldn't that happen? And there's sort of this long-standing, just to sort of give you like three sentences history of sort of this debate, but there's this long-standing debate between different Marxists over which of these two crisis theories is, you know, the real crisis theory or the appropriate one for the moment. Interestingly, like around the turn of the previous century and around 1900, the underconsumptionists were considered like the orthodox Marxists. In the 70s, in the crisis of the 70s, there was a renewed interest in the theory of the falling rate of profit. And in the current crisis, there's a lot of debate between the two camps, and sometimes fairly hostile debate between the two camps. And it's interesting, the debate sometimes takes the form of arguing whether the profit rate has actually fallen or not. So Marxists like Andrew Kleiman, who was in favor of the falling rate of profit theory, argues that the profit rate's been falling since the boom of the 50s, and that the crisis of the 70s wasn't big enough, didn't destroy enough capital. The state stepped in and tried to, like, save the economy, but through, like, you know, Keynesian spending and things like that. And so there wasn't enough devaluation. We just sort of had, like, 30 years of stagnation up to this crisis. And then there are other Marxists who argue that the profit rate has recovered throughout the 90s, 80s and 90s, and that the current crisis isn't a problem of a falling rate of profit at all, but it's a problem of low wages that, you know, couldn't buy products, and sort of this increasing speculation in the economy to boost wages or boost consumer power. And I have to admit, like, the debates are kind of hard to get a handle on, and often they're written in not the most accessible way. In my own work, I've often sided with and tried to popularize the theorists of the falling rate of profit, and that choice has sort of been for a couple of reasons. One is that I really try not to speak as my own voice in my videos, but speak as someone who's trying to, you know, help people understand Marx. So I really try to stay away from some people who've tried to, like, you know, revise theories of Marx, like the underconsumption theorists. But also because I'm, you know, probably, like, mostly convinced by the falling rate of profit arguments. But at the same time, like, I'm not saying I'm ever, like, you know, 100% convinced I'm in this camp and not the other one, or that it's even that crucial to have to take a position.
I wonder if it's crucial or not. It seems like if you – okay, just to dip my toe in this debate a bit, it seems like if you take the position that underconsumption is the problem, then regulating capital becomes possible.
Right. The idea is, yeah, that if you have you know, better unions and you know, better labor laws and wages are higher, then capitalism wouldn't go into crisis.
If you just have a balanced kind of mixed economy, maybe, then these crises won't arise, and
right.
It even leads to Keynesian kind of approach, maybe.
Yeah.
And one of your videos that really struck home for me, and I'm not attached to Marx. I'm attached to things that strike me as true, right? And so this struck me as true, and maybe it's not. But what you pointed out was that the state's coffers ultimately rely on the production of value through capitalist accumulation.
Yeah.
That if there was a decline, that if the problem was under consumption of wages, then maybe the state could step in. But with the declining rate of profit, what you're showing is that that's something that afflicts the entire system, and that no one part of it is out of balance. And if it didn't afflict the whole system, then it wouldn't be a crisis anyway, I think, is what you're saying. Because, you know, okay, if the state didn't step in, then the capitalists would just basically spend on expanding production or on their own consumer items, right?
But I just might want to take a just make a sort of a parallel point, maybe frame the question a little differently. So the falling rate of profit is sort of something very focused in what happens in production. It's a relationship of machines to workers in the workplace, really, that we're talking about. And sort of the things that are happening in the market. It's sort of not something that takes place in the marketplace. It happens in sort of these very physical ratios in the workplace. But we don't see a falling rate of profit in the factory on the shop floor, right? It's not like all of a sudden the bell goes off in the factory and people are like, oh my God, the profit rate's falling. Everyone out of the factory, right? You're only going to see the falling rate of profit in the marketplace when you go to try to sell the products of this labor. You can't sell them at a price that gives you your rate of profit, that your average rate of profit you expect in your investment. So you're going to have unsold products. There's not going to be enough demand to buy those products. So that can appear as a problem of effective demand, as an underconsumption problem. You also, like, let's say you're not able to sell your products. So what do? You're like, okay, I'm going to invest a little more in speculative assets. And so it makes it look like, you know, the crisis is sort of a problem in the sphere of finance. We always see a crisis in the separation of purchase and sale, which is a basic aspect of the commodity. The commodities that are separated in time and space, the moment of purchase and sale. And so because they're separated in time and space, there's always the possibility that you can't sell the thing back after you've bought it.
If the problem was underconsumption, then what would happen is when workers couldn't afford the products, then that given capitalist who was producing that profit would go out of business. But the overall system wouldn't be affected, because you would shift over to producing cheaper goods, or you'd shift over into providing goods for the capitalist class, or you would shift over into creating goods for production, or the state would pick up the slack. You know, it would move around.
Yeah, well, here's the argument of, like, so the classic underconsumptionist argument. Paul Sweezy had this theory of monopoly capital, and this is his sort of classic take on underconsumptionism, is that this is a basic condition of underconsumptionism, and it's leading us in this long-term tendency towards stagnation in the economy, this basic sort of stationary, stagnant state that we're approaching in the long term in the modern capitalist era. We're approaching that because, he says, all of the sort of counteracting forces that might boost up consumption sort of all have this, they're going to run out of steam eventually. So with all these things we're talking about, like the state stepping in and spending, military spending, which destroys things, just sort of buys them to destroy. And these are all real things that happen that do prop up spending, right? The military buys huge tanks and just blows them up. And then, you know, it's great for the capitalist class. But he argues that over time, all these things run out of steam. And so we get this theory of long-term stagnation. You know, the one thing you point out that I mentioned before that he doesn't talk about is this fact that capitalists can create their own demand. And there's no really inherent sort of analytical reason, unless there's some force stopping them from doing that, that they couldn't create their own demand. Now, they could. The only really thing that could really stop them from creating their own demand for capital goods would be a falling rate of profit. And that's why we need a falling rate of profit, to have some sort of theory of the inevitability of crisis. But the theory of the falling rate of profit is not a theory of long-term stagnation. It's one of cycles. It's one of booms and busts, which leads to different political conclusions. For Paul Sweezy, he saw the state as sort of taking this parental role of constant regulation, trying to create demand and boost wages and things. And he saw the role of the left as, you know, gradually taking over, trying to take on control of the state, and sort of, and eventually we sort of have this super articulated or controlled capitalist economy, and the left would just sort of take over the reins of the state, and it would sort of then just be able to, like, click the switch, and we'd be in sort of, socialism. I mean, I'm probably, like, you know, exaggerating his position a little bit too much. Probably some Paul Sweezy fan will, write to you angrily that I bastardize his politics.
I'd love to think that there are Paul Sweezy fans listening to my podcast. That'd be great.
But the theory that volume rate of profit leads us to a different conclusion. That's that crisis can be really violent and really horrible and frightening and go on for a long time and lead to wars and destroy lots of stuff. But they don't necessarily lead to the end of capitalism. That is a political project that hopefully will develop in a time of crisis, but requires some sort of political agency, different than just sort of wanting to join the welfare state. In fact, it counterposes itself to the welfare state and sees the welfare state as this sort of reformist fantasy for Keynesians.
And sometimes revolutions begin in unlikely places.
Annie, wake up.
Living in the back of a truck after a bank foreclosed on the home they had owned for 22 years, the Trody family of Miami, with the help of their neighbors, took matters into their own hands.
On behalf of this family and this community, we liberate this home for this family. Cut the sign down, take it off.
And I was really clued into this by this thing that happened at the London School of Economics about a year and a half ago, when Her Majesty the Queen asked the economists, how come you guys didn't see this thing coming? I mean, she didn't say it exactly that way, but, you know, it's just the sentiment. And they got very upset, and then she actually called the governor of the Bank of England and said, how come you didn't see it coming? And then the British Academy put forward this, got all together, all these economists, and they came up with this fabulous letter to Her Majesty. And it was it was absolutely astonishing. It said, well, you know, many dedicated people, intelligent, smart, spent their lives working on aspects of this thing very, very seriously. But the one thing we missed was systemic risk. And you say, what?
It wasn't long before the guy from the bank who had evicted them came back.
See this? I want you to go ahead and take a picture of that. The trespassing. Okay, we did an eviction here and the people went back inside the property. Yes, please. So I need police assistance.
When all these houses are empty, the value of everybody else's house go down.
Sure.
So if you can keep these people in this house, that will help not only them, but it helps.
So you see what the situation is, that the people, if the bank lets them go back inside, okay, then the bank misses the opportunity to sell the house to somebody else, okay?
They're looking for many houses right now.
Well, and then if the bank lets everybody get back inside the house for free,
have places to live.
People fighting back was an unusual sight, so 9 police cars responded to the call.
And then it went on to talk about a politics of denial and all the rest of it. So I thought, well, you know, systemic risk, you know, I can translate it into the Marxian thing. You're talking about the internal contradictions of capital accumulation. And maybe I should write a thing about the internal contradictions of capital accumulation and try to figure out the role of crises in the whole history of capitalism and what's specific and special about the crisis this time around.
This also means that the crisis of overproduction of constant capital and the subsequent falling rate of profit are displaced in time and transferred to the credit system.
I'm not going to wage 2, 4, 6 years of intense struggle like it was in the 1930s to come up with something that has a built-in self-destruct button. It's preposterous. It's not going to work. And if you do it, if the liberal left does that, imposes another set of regulations along the lines of Paul Krugman and the others, not only are you going to have the same history, but you're going to have the same history faster. And let me tell you why. Large numbers of workers are not going to go for this. They're not going to be the enthusiasts of this regulation program, precisely for the reasons I've just told you. Been there, done that.
And this takes us back to our starting point. If capital can make good on all of its credit, we are safe from crisis. But if capital can't generate enough profit relative to investments, if technological change destabilizes value creation in one way or another, we get crisis in the form of bubbles of credit which can't find value, massive factories which can't make a profit, shelves of commodities that can't be sold, and masses of workers without jobs.
Living in the back of a truck after a bank foreclosed on the home they had owned for 22 years, the Trody family of Miami, with the help of their neighbors, took matters into their own hands.
Our falling rate of profit provides a starting point for understanding how all these factors are interrelated. While there are countervailing tendencies away from a falling rate of profit, Many of them are mere displacements of crisis, which merely postpone crisis, bottling it up to break out with increasing violence when it can no longer be contained.
This proposal democratizes the enterprise. That must be good, right? I use democracy. Must be good. It must be. Everybody believes in that, like motherhood and apple pie. It democratizes. In what sense? Well, it says that the people who work in an enterprise, kind of the front line of those who have to live with what it does, where it goes, how it uses its wealth, they should be the people who have influence over the decisions. So let's do it. That's democracy. Maybe we could even extend this argument. We could say that the democracy in our political life, which, you know, needs a little to be desired. Some people call it a formal democracy that isn't real. Maybe the problem has been all along that you can't have a real democracy politically if you don't have a real democracy economically underpinning it. If the workers are not in charge of their own lives 5 days a week, 9 to 5, the basic time of their life, then how much aptitude and how much of an appetite are they going to have to control the political life when they're not too exhausted on a Saturday to go to a meeting? Maybe we need the democracy of economics not just to prevent regulations from being undone, but also in order to realize the objective, the political goals of the democracy.
Capitalism's contradictions, you know, its need to grow and its power to organize the masses under the sign of the commodity, this is what have made it work. And it's, in a way, it's made it very liberating and powerful because it's liberated us from old social relationships which were oppressive. And it seems difficult to get out from under this economy and this kind of economic system and still maintain a technological or industrial society. I think that's why people really want to get out from under it. End up in back-to-land movements and things. So I hear about how communist society might have to be really small, you know, and for people to be free and humane to each other. So I just think it's worth considering that Lenin himself had to discipline labor and institute Taylorist methods that on a massive scale in the Soviet Union, they didn't seem to really succeed in getting away from necessary socially necessary labor time or the capitalist economy. So it seemed like state communism or state socialism still kind of works under the sign of the commodity. Can you think of a way to get out from underneath the constraint of socially necessary labor time or this kind of alienating force in industrial society? Is it connected to industrial society, or how do you imagine that we could organize under something other than?
I think the question about industrialism, or you know, is it industrialism, or is it size? I think the answer is no, it's not those things, and that this is the, you know, like, what, you know, I mean, if I said yes, then your next question would be like, okay, what's the size? Like over 500 people, and you have capitalism, you know. Or like if I said yes, it was industry, what would your next question would be like, okay, like what do we have to you know, like what buildings do we have to like disassemble for us to like be at the right, you know, primitive stage of technology or something to have, like, obviously, like that logic is going like a weird place. And it doesn't actually get to the question of what is contradictory and problematic about capitalism. It's not the size of it, the capitalism, that's the problem. I mean, capitalism could be a few counties around Manchester, England, like in Marx's time, or it could be like take over the whole solar system and it was still the same problems. It could be now and it could be like in 1,000 years and it's still the same problems if there was commodity production. So the size or the level of technology, I don't think changed. And, you know, this is debated. Some people say, oh, it's different now than in Marx's time. And usually the things they mention that are different now are like things that Marx talks about in like Volume 1 of Capital. So I'm often not convinced by those people, not because I'm sort of some orthodox defender of Marx who says he's got everything right, but I'm like, you know, give the guy some like credit. Like he already talked about that. Like we already covered that in like the first class. All right. this is sort of my current like novel way I like to think about the Marxist project, and that's this question of how to get out of a room with no exits. This is what I think sort of that Marx is trying to get at. How do you get out of this room with no exits? Well, the first question you ask yourself is like, how do I know to look? How do I know that there are no exits if there are no exits? Right? Like, how do I know that there's anything except for this room? Right? For bourgeois ideology, we're always told that this room is all there is. They define capital in a way that makes it sound like capital has always existed. They like say capital is just like stuff that you use to make more stuff, like as if like the axes used by the Iroquois Indians are like capital. You know, Marx is saying, no, actually, we know that like there's something outside of this room. Because we have this sort of sense of this historical thing. We look into the past and see that like this, there's something very particular about this. So he's always trying to define like the particular and not letting off the universals, not say, oh, it's always been this way, or there's always been class, or there's always been exploitation. He's always saying, no, there's something very particular about this that's unique to capital. And this is part of his project of trying to see outside of this room, right? And we can define the present as something that's particular in relation to the past. Then we have a sense that like this room is not some universal thing that you can't get out of. But that still doesn't tell us quite yet like what leads us, you know, what might lead out of it. It just tells us kind of how we got to the room. So for Marx, like the other question is like, so how do we know, like back to the thing, like how do we know that there are exits to look for? And that's because like this contradictory relationship to these concepts of freedom and equality and things we have in a capitalist society that we've been talking about. We think that we're free. We have this concept that we want to be in control of our lives. We have this idea of quality, that we're all sort of the same as people, as workers. We all are like, we're not, you know, I'm not a king and you're not like a serf, and we're all like the same, made up of the same sort of social substance. Yeah, we know we live in a society of like vast inequality and that people are not free. And even, you know, even people in the advanced industrial world with cell phones still like are chained to their desks and do alienating work. And so there's this contradiction that needs to be interrogated. In the process of interrogating this contradiction, Marx discovers that a capitalist society is sort of rife to the core with all of these contradictions. And his project, so this vast scheme that is Marx, is trying to make a sense of all these contradictions. How do they relate to each other? How do they fit into some sort of puzzle that makes sense? And this is like the project of Capital. His book Capital is creating like an ordering to these concepts so we can see how they relate to each other. Different, and that makes the project of getting out of this room not some utopian vision where we say like, oh, wouldn't it be great if like we all unicorns and all the cheese fries we wanted or something? It's like this very specific project of like, what is it that we would take to get out of this room? Like, what do we need to change? For someone like Lenin, it was private property. We needed to, and so for Lenin, it was very simple. Like, the state takes over all the property, it's socialized because the state owns it, and that will, you know, eventually that will lead to communism. But for Lenin also, and so if you read like the Bolshevik economists all through the years, you know, before and after the revolution, they were talking about the operation of the law of value in the Soviet Union, explicitly. Like I have this textbook by Leontiev. Have you say his name? And so it has this whole chapter called "The Operation of the Law of Value in the Soviet Union," which is supposedly a socialist republic, right? For Marx, I think, and the product of defining capitalism, it's the law of value that is the defining characteristic of capitalism. That's sort of the starting point at which we understand this whole picture that is all the contradictions of capitalism. And so rather than, I think, Marx giving us some sort of like treasure map to get out of the room with no exits, it's about giving us like a method which to understand like the analytical possibility of escape. Does that make sense?
Yeah, the dialectical method, right? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, it's sort of a Marxist specific dialectical method by which we understand the relationship of these categories and sort of their relationship to history. We're in a historical moment we've been in since the dawn of capitalism. We want to like get out of this historical moment. We have to understand sort of the analytic possibilities. We can't just dream of any society. There are only certain societies that are possible. The society that we can imagine is one where we don't have the law of value. That's basically the society we're talking about when we talk about getting out of capitalism. It's like we have to abolish the law. So this is sort of like an sort of an analytical process at this point. It's not like you have to do X, Y, and Z, or this is specifically how the society would be run. The question is like, I feel like Marx sort of gives you that on the platter, and that's like sort of the extent, or like that's the project is presenting this possibility. People like to talk about the fact that Marx doesn't really talk about a model for a socialist society ever, which I think is, you know, true. Like he was really against like blueprints and things like that. But there's a lot that we can know about what a socialist society would be like from this basic critique of the law of value. We know that we can't have production for exchange. We know that we can't have private ownership of property. We know that we can't have abstract labor. We know that we have, and that would require some sort of drastic reconceptualization of the division of labor. We're not going to have things like, you know, money and markets and trade. And these are like the basic ingredients that we have to work with. We have to think about like, how would you structure things and not have these things? And that's what the project is all about. And unfortunately, I think a lot of 20th century Marxism has not been devoted to this particular project of like, you know, working out what a society would not dominated by the law of value would be like. It's been sort of concerned with other questions, unfortunately.
The man tells you when to go to work, when you'll get your break, when you'll get your lunch, how much you'll get paid, whether or not you'll get benefits, and when to take a walk when he doesn't need you. I'd say that's working class.
Each person is at the end of a lonely node out there by themselves, governed by a mainframe whose name they don't know.
They can't demonize the corporations. I mean, what if you tried? Try to do something. Look around here. Is there anything that wasn't made by a corporation? Is my sustenance not delivered every day through a corporate-owned ATM? It is their environment. It is their consciousness. It's not just the advertisement. It's football. It's everything.
The anecdotal part of our lives, the stuff life is really made of and how it's lived, was devalued. All of a sudden, it was just anecdotal evidence. You know, wasn't any good. Wasn't any good. It also happens to be the stories people tell about their lives. You know,
there's that discontent, a rising anxiety. It's getting very like something's going on. It's like a siren in the room, but nobody knows its name. They don't know what to call it.
What's Joe's version of the American dream?
Fairness, justice, the thing that's right, you know. Working people or philosophers all have that there. It just seems to be some kind of a internal scale. And if you can go to the most fundamental level of what is just, there's no man so brutal by labor that he will not recognize that if you keep it fundamental and right enough. Struggle is for the consciousness of the planet, the consciousness of that smear of biology on a speck of cosmic dust. There's a spiritual side of man, there's a moral side. I'm not a Christian, but it's there, and it's there for us to share as a people together.
I'm gonna build a cabin 18 stories high. Then I can watch my Donnie girl when she goes traipsing by. I won't get drunk no more, boys, I won't get drunk no more. I won't get drunk no more, boys, and walk this old plank road.
All right.
That's not my key to singing.
Well, that just about wraps up this week's episode of the Diet Soap Podcast. I want to thank Brendan Cooney for coming on the show, and I look forward to having him come back. I also want to thank Forrest for letting me know about the counterinsurgency convergence that will be taking place on the Reed College campus this weekend. I plan on attending this since it's an easy walking distance from the Diet Soap headquarters, and I'll put a link to this in my show notes. So if anyone out there listening to the podcast wants to meet me at this counterinsurgency convergence, well, just send me an email through douglaslane.com or to douglane@gmail.com. The music this week included Out and Up by Cooney's Rhinoceri Trio, Steve Reich's Marimba Phase, and the YouTube star Ryman Fan covering John Lennon's classic Working Class Hero on his ukulele. Right now, you're listening to the Rhinoceri Trio cover Ornette Coleman's Lonely Woman. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Miriam with this week's Titanic Factoid.
Members of the Titanic's crew began to arrive at 5:18 a.m. That was just after sunrise on sailing day, April 10, 1912. But the officers, with the exception of Captain Smith, had already spent the night on board. There were three senior officers. They were Chief Officer Henry Wilde, First Officer William Murdoch, Second Officer Charles Lightoller. And then there were four junior officers. They were 3rd Officer Herbert Pittman, 4th Officer Joseph Boxhall, 5th Officer Harold Lowe, and 6th Officer James Moody. So these folks managed day-to-day activities, navigating the ship when it was their turn on duty, but they also had individual tasks. Wilde, for example, updated the ship's log. Boxhall updated the ship's charts, and Lowe and Moody were actually assigned to measure the air and water temperatures every day. And of course, they would do that with a pen and paper. Then of course there was Captain Smith. He arrived at the Titanic at 7:30 a.m., having said goodbye to his wife and daughter at 7 a.m. He took a taxi to the dock from his Southampton home. This was to be his very last voyage. He was 62 years old and had been sailing for 38 years with the White Star Line. So he was due to retire at the end of the Titanic's maiden voyage. He was called the Millionaire's Captain, but this was not because he made a lot of money. He earned about £1,250 a year, which translates to $6,250 a year, and then he got a bonus of £200 if none of the ships he captained had an accident, which didn't work out in this case. But the reason he was called the Millionaire's Captain was because he was cheerful and well-liked by wealthy people, many of whom would even make a special point of reserving tickets on his ships.